Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Guiding Heart Failure Therapy, an update on the role of biomarkers, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Ileana L. Pena, MD, MPH, G. Michael Felker, MD, and James L. Januzzi, MD. Dr. Pena is a professor of medicine, epidemiology, and biostatistics, Case Western Reserve University, VA Quality Scholar, Lewis Stokes VA Medical Center, Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Pena has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for the FDA, GE Healthcare, and Otsuka Pharmaceutical. She served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Novartis Pharmaceuticals, and Solvay Pharmaceuticals. She received grants for clinical research from the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Pena does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Pena does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Felker is an associate professor of medicine and clinical pharmacology, director of heart failure research, Duke Clinical Research Institute, Duke University Medical Center, Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Felker has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Roche, Amgen, Cytokinetics, Corthera, and BG Medicine. He received grants for clinical research from Roche, Amgen, Cytokinetics, Corthera, BG Medicine, and Otsuka Pharmaceutical. Dr. Felker does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Felker does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Januzzi is an associate professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School, director, Cardiac Intensive Care Unit, Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Januzzi has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Roche and Critical Diagnostics. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Roche and Ortho Clinical Diagnostics. He received grants for clinical research from Roche, Siemens, and Critical Diagnostics. Dr. Januzzi does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Januzzi does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goal of this activity is to update healthcare providers on the clinical use of biomarkers in treatment strategies and recent trial data on the use of biomarkers in specific population groups. This activity is supported by Roche Diagnostics. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Ileana Pena, Professor of Medicine, Epidemiology, and Biostatistics at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And it is my pleasure today to welcome you to our program entitled Guiding Heart Failure Therapy, an update on the role of biomarkers. And I'm joined today by James Januzzi, who's Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard and the Director of the Cardiac Intensive Care Unit at the Mass General in Boston. And I'm also joined by my good friend Mike Felker, who's Associate Professor of Medicine at Duke University in North Carolina. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for being here. I would like to remind our audience today that we will be discussing investigational agents that are not yet approved for use in the U.S. And so, Jim, you've brought us a case, and I think that could really kick off the discussion. So I will turn it over to you.
Thanks, Ileana. So this, I think, frames the discussion well because it speaks to the topic of what do biomarkers add to a clinical picture, right? Because we approach patients clinically every day in our office, and this is a nice example of where biomarkers may add something. So,
and you told me it was real.
It's a real case. I pulled this one out of my clinical practice, from a couple of weeks ago.
That's even better. So go on.
So this is an 80-year-old male patient who has a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, presumed actually from chemotherapy exposure. His ejection fractions are on 25%, and he came into the office for his routine follow-up. At baseline, he's around New York Heart Association class 2, and he had been admitted for acutely decompensated heart failure about 3 months ago. And over the period of time from follow-up, he felt actually quite well. He had really gotten back to his baseline. And he had no evidence at all for congestive symptoms. He was very carefully adherent to his medication program and was basically just coming in for essentially a follow-up visit. He had seen another cardiologist in the community who had subsequently referred him in to see me.
So those 3 months, was it your group taking care of him?
No, he was seen in the community.
Out in the community, mm-hmm. Okay.
So his relevant history, he has hypertension, he's in atrial fibrillation, and has chronic kidney disease, a fairly common combination in a patient such as this. His ejection fraction is 25% with moderate mitral regurgitation. Not very dilated, interestingly, typical of a post-chemotherapy heart. He was on 20 milligrams of lisinopril, 12 and a half twice a day of carvedilol, and 40 milligrams of furosemide, a good program for someone at class 2, I would say. And his blood pressure, 112 over 58, heart rate is 60, 62 in AF. Jugular venous pressure on exam was only 6. He had clear lungs. He did have an S3 Gallop and an MR murmur, and he was warm but without any evident edema. On electrocardiography, AFib, nothing really to say. In an incomplete right bundle, he wasn't wide. QRS duration of only 108. And his labs came back after we finished seeing him with a serum creatinine of 1.8 and an NT-proBNP of 5,280. So, overall, the clinical picture is of a warm and dry individual on a reasonably good program, yet the labs obviously come back with some worrisome findings.
So what do you think about this? And, Mike, let me turn to you. And how would you approach this gentleman? Here he is. He looks pretty good. You think his output is good. He's got a decent blood pressure. He's been on some meds. I probably could optimize some of those a little bit. But, I mean, he's been on a good regimen.
So, I think this is a great case because it illustrates a very common scenario where someone's on kind of medium doses of a lot of the drugs that we think of are useful. He has some blood pressure to work with still, although he's certainly normotensive. His heart rate's only in the 60s, so that may be an issue with beta blockers. And when you ask the patient, how are you doing, they say, I'm doing fine.
I feel great, Doc.
That's right.
Wonderful.
So, and I think there's a certain kind of what I'll call therapeutic inertia for both the doctors and the patient.
He looks okay. Let's not break anything.
Yeah. And we've checked all the boxes. He's on all the medicines he's supposed to be. And then how to integrate that with the lab data, which the NT-proBNP level certainly suggestive of still a pretty high degree of risk. Mm-hmm. And how do you integrate that fact into the decision making and with the other aspects of the clinical picture?
Does the S3 Gallop move you to? I mean, the fact that the S3 Gallop could be all MR. Just the jet hitting the ventricle.
It's very challenging because this assessment of congestion, our skill set, even for very good clinicians, is we're very limited in terms of looking at JVP, peripheral edema, S3 rails. These are not actually very sensitive signs, so people can certainly have what I'll call subclinical congestion, elevated filling pressures, even in the setting of a physical exam that seems pretty normal.
Yeah, but again, the S3 gives you a little guide that maybe his filling pressures were high.
I think it's a positive predictive value thing. I mean, I think if the S3 is present, you know that we're not entirely optimal, even if the patient says they're feeling fine. You have no other overt findings to support congestion. We all know the lungs can be totally clear in the presence of a markedly elevated wedge pressure, for example. So I think it is useful. I think the combination of the elevated natriuretic peptide together with the S3 Gallop, there are many clinicians that have basically sworn up and down they can predict what the BNP value is going to be based on whether the S3 is there or not. But I think when the two are present, you really have a good sense that the patient's probably congested.
Not that easy. And the MR is interesting, too, if he's not that dilated. So let's go on with this case. What do you think about the age and where he sits in that heart failure spectrum, either one of you?
Age is obviously probably the biggest non-modifiable risk factor in heart failure management. It's a problem. And The issue with elders in general in heart failure is to use the term that Mike used, this therapeutic inertia issue. You know, we see this all the time, we get to a dose of medication, and because of concerns about side effects, because of increased intolerances, often patients get to a point, but they may not get quite where you want to get them to.
And that's the age that you worry about the most, where some of the data. So let's look at the rest of your information here, and I know that you're going to be presenting additional data from your PROTECT trial, so
right.
Do you want to walk us through this?
Sure. So you know, the challenges in patients like this, obviously, is understanding the volume status, and I think that this is not isolated just to elders. This is a problem in general in chronic heart failure management. But the real question, the million-dollar question at this point now, is trying to ascertain if we've got the patient maximized, truly maximized on medications. This concept that Mike and I have talked about frequently is, you know, when you think a patient is maximized, whether it's an elder or a younger patient or not, frequently you find out that you may not have been exactly right. I mean,
in itself is such a great message to clinicians. Yeah. Like you were saying, stop, take a look. You're on medium doses. You check the boxes. Can you tweak? Yeah. Can you do a little bit better?
And I think one reason this is a great case, again, as clinicians grapple with this, because you could certainly come up with some justifications for his NT-proBNP being high that might not necessarily be related to his heart failure. You might be tempted to say, well, he's got chronic renal insufficiency,
right.
He's got chronic atrial fibrillation,
right.
He's elderly, and you might be tempted to just kind of attribute the elevated NT-proBNP level to all those things and say, I don't need to really do anything else.
Would you walk him?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
we do that very frequently.
Even just down the hallway.
Well, I think that's one of the most simple diagnostic tests do, because, you know, a person will say, I feel great, doc, terrific, and then you watch them, and we have in our office setting this long hallway down and a long hallway this way. And so I'll watch them walk out and watch them walk down the hall.
Yeah.
And you can really get a sense of really what feeling great really is when they show that they
can't
walk.
The heart failure clinic should always be at the end of the hallway, so they have to walk a long time to get there.
No question.
Show us some of those data that you have.
So the relevant challenge is understanding whether a patient is dry, knowing whether or not they're truly maximized, and then the role of an objective tool like a biomarker, in our view, is, you know, not just to identify the presence and severity of heart failure, but to monitor these people, to really get a good read on their overall level of stability. And then lastly, you know, although it's an emerging concept, tailoring the therapy to baseline risk, and in particular, identifying the highest risk patients, What we know about natriuretic peptides is that, you know, a single measurement here or there, such as in the Valhef study, identified risk, whether it's, you know, a risk for death or a risk for heart failure hospitalization. Lower values are better, higher values are worse. There's no question about that. But what we also know based on the data from Valhef is that while a single measurement is useful, serial measurements seem to inform even better prognostic value.
At least admission and discharge?
Well, for acute heart failure.
Should we get it every day?
I think that we're now kind of moving out of the guidelines into clinical practice.
Right.
My own personal practice for patients hospitalized, to get it on admission, certainly get it again at discharge, because I think looking at the degree of drop is a very useful thing in helping assess how decongested, how successful have we been at decongesting this person.
And then
sometimes
I'll
get it.
Success of your hospitalization.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting hypothesis that could be tested.
You know, Mike's group, shown that, you know, a robust fall in hospitalization is a marker of success of therapy.
Right.
And how we define success of therapy remains to be seen. The point here now, because of all of the focus on hospital to home, you know, this is an ideal opportunity to sort of get the read in the hospital, get it at discharge, pick it up in the office, and continue running with the same monitoring tool.
Especially since you're going to see them at a 7 to 10 day
exactly.
point. So walk us through this, Mikey. Yeah. What do you think about this drop of in the hospital?
So I think what's interesting about the change over time, we're so used to thinking of risk factors as this baseline sort of thing. You have a risk factor like you have chronic renal insufficiency or age or whatever. But that's not how we practice medicine, of course.
Right.
We don't just see people one time and then send them off. We see them over time. And so I think the idea of following these markers and how they change over time really integrates much better with the way we practice clinical medicine. And it gives you, I mean, the way I like to think of this, or these are clues that may be more sensitive than our clinical assessment of the patient or the patient's symptoms. So you can get early signals where things might be moving in the wrong direction, And so I think the idea of a serial measurement is very useful, and the data certainly strongly supports this idea that that what direction you're moving is actually more important than where you start. So patients who start, even if they start with a very favorable low level of natriuretic peptide, if it's becoming more elevated over time, that's a very worrisome sign.
Yeah, and I like the point to clinicians, if it's dropping down, you must be doing something right with your medication, with your medical therapy, and gives them some sense of confidence. So
and these changes mean something, you know. So you can have, as Mike said, someone that's improving over time, but you can also have people that reclassify themselves from low risk to higher risk if they're rising over time. And the goal of monitoring with a marker like a natriuretic peptide is that we have therapeutic interventions that directly affect the physiology that drives those natriuretic peptide values. And so this concept of guiding therapy has gained momentum now, which is to say that we have a tool that's useful for identifying risk, but I think all three of us would agree that knowing your patient is at high risk doesn't necessarily change the outcome of that patient.
Right,
the
correct.
Knowledge of risk, as we've seen again and again in medicine, doesn't affect therapy unless there's something you can do about that risk.
Right,
and
exactly.
So we know now that there are therapies that can change the level of the biomarker in parallel with lowered risk, whether it's the use of diuretics, which we try to minimize as much as possible, but in very congested
but
patients.
But it does work.
Oh, sure.
It does work.
In extraordinarily congested patients.
I like the aldosterone antagonists there.
No question.
Especially in light of emphysis and the new data.
I think one interesting thing about this is a framework we don't think of in heart failure very much with regard to specific therapies, is if you see a patient, you think he's high risk, and you think, I'm going to do something different with this therapy. You don't really have a way to know what did it work. I've changed something. I've added something.
Right.
Did that accomplish what I'm? Mm-hmm, have we changed his risk profile? And I think this kind of gives you give you a real time read on response versus non response.
So patients, because the patient's symptoms may not change
exactly.
Much.
So
or
you
at
add
all.
A
at all.
You add adjust a dose, add a new medicine, and if you see that the natriuretic peptide level has fallen, then you feel like that's probably doing something useful. It's analogous to the way we take care of a lot of other chronic diseases like diabetes or hypercholesterolemia.
But the data hasn't always been consistent, and there have been some positive and some negative trials.
Right. Yeah, so this is an important thing for the viewing audience to recognize, that these trials are all very different in design with different outcome measures, different approaches to the patient. So I warn people when they look at this space to really review the trials individually so they really understand that while there's some positives.
And the ages of the patients.
Sure, ages, baseline age, different designs. If you look at the studies that were negative, there are a few, and in general, the negative trials tended to examine patients that were a little bit older. The physicians managing the patients were not typically universally cardiologists.
Right.
And I think it's an important message that heart failure is a challenging specialty.
Yes.
They included patients with heart failure syndromes that might not necessarily be as responsive to standard medical management. I'm speaking largely of heart failure with preserved EF.
Right.
These negative trials often had heart failure with preserved EF. Their target natriuretic peptide values, perhaps the most common reason why we saw negative results for these trials, was either their target was too high or they didn't achieve the target they set.
Even during the trial.
Even during the trial. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's not sufficient to set a goal if you don't reach it.
If you're not going to get there.
Yeah. Right. So that common thread through the negative trials is pretty consistent. On the other hand, the consistent thread through the trials that have been positive are typically patients with systolic heart failure where we have a clearly defined therapeutic strategy.
Where we know the guidelines, we know what to do.
The successful trials had low targets for their natriuretic peptides and they consistently met
target
values. And so, when we get to the data, for example, in the PROTECT study, our recent guided therapy trial, our baseline natriuretic peptide value in these patients was around 2,000.
Not huge, but
fairly representative of a patient population enrolled in a heart failure clinic.
Right.
The difference between PROTECT and other studies, however, is that in PROTECT, the guided therapy arm, the NT-proBNP arm, had a 50% reduction in the NT-proBNP concentrations, which is very significant compared to the standard of care arm where there was no change. The difference in the standard of care arm was not even biological variability.
Isn't that interesting? It went down just a tiny little bit, and there were some adjustments in medications, if I can remember your data well.
And Mike is very facile with the natriuretic peptides. You know, seeing a change from 1946 to 1844.
Yeah,
does that mean anything?
No, I think that's well within the framework of what we call biologic variability.
Right.
This data again shows that using the marker to change therapy, you intensify therapy, as you've shown nicely in PROTECT. And it also, it's two parts. One, you're intensifying the therapy. Two, and it's actually impacting your marker. Because intensifying therapy and showing no impact on the marker, you may not necessarily be doing any good. Your intensification may be choosing the wrong medicines.
And I mean, we often think the patients are doing well because they haven't been back in the hospital,
right,
because they're not calling us,
right,
or weight is stable,
right,
and we feel comfortable that they're doing well,
right,
but those numbers aren't changing.
One thing we've learned, I think, from the trials is that, the lower is better. It's a little bit like the way that field of LDL has moved.
First
we were targeting 130 and then 100 and now 70 potentially. So I think we're...
So a really good analogy, actually.
We're learning that driving it lower and lower makes a...
Here are your values with your events. Is this from your PROTECT trial?
Correct. These are data from PROTECT. Okay. We're presenting these at the meetings currently. And basically, there was a lot of apprehension about what's the optimal cut point to shoot for. We chose 1,000 based on a number of studies, including some from our own, as well as the Valhef study. But people were concerned that by shooting low, we might increase the risk for adverse outcomes, side effects, etc. The bottom line is, at least when you're speaking of outcomes in terms of event rates, it's essentially linear, even in a small cohort like
PROTECT.
That's
really, really linear. Wow.
You know, the lower we go, as Mike said, the better. And so, if one can achieve a low value for NT-proBNP in the course of aggressive heart failure management, it's highly desirable.
Yep.
Now, as one would expect, given that we halved the NT-proBNP values in the guided arm, the overall primary endpoint was driven by a more than 50% reduction in heart failure hospitalization, which is obviously a very significant and robust finding.
And very timely is what we're looking at.
And it's interesting how aligned the relative risk reduction actually mirrors the reduction in NT-proBNP.
About
half the NT-proBNP, 50% decrease, 50% decrease.
Yeah, I like that.
And what's interesting about these results, if you review the positive guided therapy trials, and even some of the negative ones like TIME-CHF, in the patients in whom a robust reduction in NT-proBNP was observed, the magnitude of effect was very similar to this. It's not a small magnitude of effect.
So there's consistency even within these these trials.
And
your age group, which to me is fascinating, because a lot of these European trials have shown clearly that over 75, it doesn't work. Well, is it physician inertia? Is it physician fear that these older patients are going to have side effects?
Yeah.
And that's why I asked you about the AFib rate, because if you walk him and his ventricular rate all of a sudden goes up to 100, he's not beta blocked. It's the best example.
So the point that you made about some of these guided therapy trials being negative in the elder population, if you look at it on the surface, you think the approach doesn't work in these patients.
Right.
It's when you scratch the surface and look underneath and you try to understand in these trials how they approach the patients versus how we did in PROTECT, you start seeing differences. So, for example, in PROTECT, we saw no difference on a statistical level with respect to the reductions in risk in the guided therapy arms. The absolute reductions were quite significant, however, in the elderly population.
Yeah.
So while the relative reductions were similar, the absolute reductions were greater because of the higher baseline risk.
Yeah.
Right.
So, Jim, what do you think explains? So, your findings in the elderly and PROTECT are definitely different than a lot of the other trials. So, do you think the difference was in patients? Difference was in the approach to patients?
Yeah.
The strategy.
It
what do you think
strategy.
Accounted for that?
Yeah, it was the strategy, Mike. So, PROTECT at its core, much like trials that we're all talking about, doing. At its core, PROTECT was a good clinical medicine trial.
Mm-hmm,
we didn't have, as some trials have, a set number of visits for the patients.
Right.
If an elderly patient needed to come back more frequently, we brought them back more frequently.
It was clinical. It was really, truly clinical.
We titrated their meds more gently, perhaps. We found some interesting things. For example, the NT-proBNP values in elders were certainly higher at baseline than the younger patients, as was seen.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike in other trials, we actually achieved significant lowering in the elderly population. It took extra visits, however,
and
it took more med titrations, but we got there. The other thing that we found was that the drug therapy profiles in these patients coming into the trial, and we're presenting these data today, actually, at the meetings at the American College of Cardiology meetings. The elders were more likely to be on lower doses of beta blocker or not even on a beta blocker.
Even coming in.
Other cardiologists referring them in.
That's that perception that we were talking about.
Right, and we were able to up-titrate them well. What we found from a tolerability perspective was the fact that patients in the elderly population who were randomized to NT-proBNP guidance definitely had a higher rate of dizziness, for example, maybe a trend towards more hypotension. Mm-hmm. But if you look at both arms, the standard of care arm and the NT-pro,
they did too.
Yeah, I mean, aggressive heart failure care, you know, I won't be cavalier and say that if you don't make some people hypotensive, you're not being aggressive enough, but I will say that it's not unexpected.
Right, right. But if the blood pressure drops and you can adjust the diuretics, which is usually what I would do, is cut back on the diuretic or give it. What do you think about that, Mike, adjusting diuretics?
No, I think it's, I mean, and I think one of the very interesting things in PROTECT is the signal that actually more aggressive heart failure management allows for less diuretic. So very often, these people on kind of low doses of norhormonal antagonists and a high dose of diuretic, you know, there's the opportunity to kind of flip that profile.
Right.
So high doses of norhormonal antagonists, better management of the underlying condition, and less need, less sodium retention, less congestion, less need for high dose loop diuretics.
That's a great message in itself, because it's
crucial.
A message that we have been trying to push for a while. Think about cutting back the diuretics while you up everything else.
Yeah.
And I think it also steps back a little bit on having renal dysfunction, because you're pre-renally, you know, even though it may be transient.
And I think all of us who take care of these patients, you know, there are tricks that you learn about
dealing with
these symptoms of dizziness and lightheadedness. I mean, you know, you take your ACE inhibitor before you go to bed.
Right.
There's some other things.
We did a lot of that, actually.
Split the dosing instead of giving it all at once. So
ACE
I think there are ways you can...
ACE inhibitor in the morning, mid-morning, your beta blocker.
So I think there are ways you can manage through that and achieve the benefit without having the downside.
That's right.
Yeah.
So tell us about this remodeling. You know, we always look to the ventricle. What have we done? And it's turning out that the end-systolic volume index is becoming a very important marker.
It's huge. So we, you know, in the heart failure community, recognize there are a number of different surrogates that one can look at for outcomes. And one that seems to be coming up again and again, as you say, are measures of remodeling, whether it's volumes or even just LV ejection fraction.
Yep.
So one of the questions that we asked in PROTECT, we knew that patients did better clinically. We also knew they felt better. We did health status analyses and you know, quality of life improved. But one of the questions that we asked was, you know, could we be on a biological level doing something more than just drying them out and getting to a higher dose of a medication? What are the mechanistic correlates of improvement?
The structural.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we looked first at the associations between natriuretic peptides in all subjects and the risk for remodeling. So what we found was that a higher natriuretic peptide value from baseline to the end of the trial was associated with a higher hazard for remodeling, bigger volumes, and drop in ejection
fraction. Wow, in a short period of time, you know, we think of remodeling sometimes across years, but this is not that long.
Yeah, and I'll remind you that the patients in PROTECT were fresh off of a decompensated event.
Right.
So we got them at a vulnerable period.
Yeah. It's the best time.
Yeah. I mean, that's a period I think that's crucial, because it's both a focus of better management. We're trying to decrease rehospitalization.
Right.
It's also an opportunity, both in terms of medication adjustment and also in terms of it's kind of a teachable moment for patients.
Right.
They just
had
this bad outcome, and kind of a lot of them are now recommitted to managing their disease.
Good patient education.
I think this biologic data is fascinating, because it really speaks to this question of is this just a disease management strategy, or are you just figuring out a better way to manage diuretics, or are you having some biologic effect? And this really suggests the latter, these changes are actually making a biologic impact on the ventricle, which we know is favorable.
And what we found was that, you know, when you look at patients as a function of LV volumes or LV ejection fraction, patients in the standard of care arm were more likely to have a fall in their EF and a rise in their LV volumes, whereas with NT-proBNP allocation, you're more likely to either have no change or an improvement. You know,
I mean, if you think of the intraventricular pressure right on the wall and you're decreasing that, that itself may trigger the reverse remodeling that we want to see.
And what's interesting about that is, besides remodeling, we found effects on other things that were pressure-driven, so diastolic function, RV pressures. Now, these may not be as tightly linked, for example, with outcomes. But, to be sure, when you look at the echoes of these patients...
Diastolic dysfunction is probably very much linked to outcomes. Yeah. Absolutely.
No, I think it just all... I mean, it's all integrated, right? The heart is systole and is diastole and diastole is systole. I mean, they all these things point to the same thing, which is that the heart is happier.
Looks better. It's happier.
You put a little smile on the happy
heart. Right. So, you know, what we found consistently through PROTECT is that, you know, there are many patients that come in with marked elevations in their natriuretic peptide values, and we've been able to bring them down, you know, with adjustments in therapy.
This
is a nice example. Many people came into the trial on guideline-compliant medication programs, So, like, Mike, how do you think of that?
Check the box.
Well, I think there's, there's what I like to call evidence-based homeopathy. So we have a lot of people who kind of, they know, I'm supposed to be on a beta blocker, I'm supposed to be on an ACE inhibitor.
Yeah, that's what I call the checkbox.
And they've kind of started a low dose of each of those things, and then they don't have the aggressive adjustment again.
Never do it again.
Because the patient says, I'm feeling fine and everything seems
and
good.
And I think working with the patient early on and saying to them, I'm going to make adjustments because I'm tracking something, I'm following something, rather than just how you feel.
Right.
There are things going on.
I think that's actually a critical point because it impacts patient behavior across the board.
And their expectations.
So it's just like patients who are focused on their cholesterol and they say,
What's my number?
Exactly.
That drives a lot of people.
That drives things about diet. And this is the same thing. A patient, if we say, this is a number you can hang your hat on, and we know the lower it gets,
and
the
I
better.
Have a reason for increasing your medicines, not just because I want to give you the latest and the greatest.
And we can identify bad behavior. You know, it's funny. We've sort of smoked out a few people that were either not taking their medications or were having high salt meals, and their numbers were bouncing all over the place. It's like the person on warfarin whose INR goes up and down because they don't adhere to their diet,
for example,
or they're not taking.
So here's a question for you: do we know the variability of BNP within, let's say you have lunch and now the blood flow is going to your gut and less blood flow perhaps in the coronary bed? What happens to BNP? What happens to BNP an hour after you've taken the ACE inhibitor? Do we even know those daily variability?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think I can speak to hour, but definitely in days there is some degree of biologic variability, just like with anything else with blood pressure or anything else. But I don't, just like when you take people's blood pressure, there's biologic variability in that, but we don't toss out blood pressure as useless because of that. So I think usually the changes that we're seeing, especially at the levels we're talking about in studies like PROTECT, they drown out the biologic variability. They're much greater. So I think there is a signal-to-noise issue, but I think the changes we're seeing clearly are signal and can be seen through the noise.
So, day-to-day, you expect, not so much day-to-day, maybe more week-to-week, about 25% change.
This looks pretty
right. So here's another example of an elder. What we found is that in some cases, the numbers would go down a little bit with each therapy change. And we struggle a little bit with, is this biological variability, 25% change? But then you have examples where you have these remarkable responses to the initiation.
I mean, look at this, 6,000 down to 500. That's amazing.
And this is down and sustained down. So here's one of the interesting things that we'll never be able to inform from PROTECT necessarily, but this is a nice example, I believe, of pharmacogenetics, which is that this is a lady who came into the trial on a guideline-compliant medication program. Her NT-pro was 6,000, and we added an aldosterone blocker because she was class 2. This was pre-emphasis. And, we added an aldo blocker, and she had this remarkable plummet in her natriuretic peptide values. And so I do believe that, one of the things that we see when we get a response like this is that we found the drug that was missing.
You found the right drug.
This is what I was talking about, responders, non-responders.
Right.
For that person, you added something, and you knew within weeks that what you had done had made a major biologic effect.
That's right.
Which is,
and it stayed.
Right.
Which is the other thing. Now, here's another example. This is a young person. Right?
Yeah. So the interesting story about this patient is that, he had all of the hallmarks of someone that we'd be able to titrate down. We thought for sure we were going to get our arm around this guy, and And no matter what we did, his values just would not go down. They bounced all over the place, but they really never consistently stayed in a range.
Bad signal.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an interesting point. That what we've learned in the concept of guided therapy is that when it doesn't work, when you are unable to guide someone with natriuretic peptides, it's not that the strategy doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It's that the patient is very sick. Their heart is a problem.
Something you can't change.
And so no matter what we did, we couldn't suppress his values. So then we shifted gears, and we tried first an invasive approach using an implantable hemodynamic monitor to try to get a more direct read on his left atrial pressures. That didn't work. He came in with acutely decompensated heart failure and ultimately got a HeartMate. An LVAD.
Yeah, and here's a good point. The rapid rise there at the end, and that's when he gets admitted.
Yeah.
And so it makes you think of the rapid rise in pressures that predates symptoms. As we're starting to wrap up here, what I want to hear from Mike now is what's coming up, Mike? What do you see? I know you work in the biomarker world, and you're thinking ahead of many of us.
So I think, you know, we're at a very interesting time now. I think we've talked about today. If you look at this biomarker-guided concept, we have this mix of kind of small to medium-sized trials, some positive, some negative. There's a lot of confusion in the community about what to do with all this, and a lot of people have just kind of thrown up their hands and said, I can't make sense of all this. I think just like in chasing a new drug, we need bigger trials, trials with more power, trials that are statistically powered to look at subgroups. And
for longer time, too.
Yeah, so I think a trial that we've all been working on, and hopefully will be funded by the NIH this fall.
If they get the message on this video, absolutely.
Is GUIDED, which will be a large outcome trial, 1,100 patients, long-term follow-up. Really, I think a robust test of this natriuretic peptide guided strategy.
And a protocol to follow with the drugs.
Yeah, so I think, across a diffuse group of sites, so seeing how it works in academic centers versus the community. So I think this is a good example of how the field of biomarkers, as it moves from mostly being a diagnostic field into a field where we're trying to impact therapy, we really have to learn the lessons of evidence-based medicine that come with developing new drugs. And then the other thing I'll say is we've been very focused on natriuretic peptides today, but we're really at an interesting time in the biomarkers world because there's a variety of new markers, some old markers like troponin or uric acid, a variety of new markers like ST2 and galectin-3, that are coming onto the scene, and I think moving forward, how we use, how we incorporate those with things with the natriuretic peptides and the clinical information that we're all used to, and some of those markers may be dynamic markers like NT-proBNP that change over time, and we follow how they change. Mm-hmm. Other of them, maybe what I'll call more phenotypic markers that don't change very much over time, but just identify a certain type of patient who's more or less
that
likely
may be
to
the
respond
gene identification to. That we were talking about earlier.
So they may be attached to a specific intervention, one drug or even a device. You know, so for example, we may have markers that in a patient walking into your office, if they're elevated, if they're high, you know that patient's not going to do well with medical management.
Right.
And so you may want to shift your view to a more invasive support kind of approach.
Yeah, it may shift your whole approach.
And this is all happening simultaneous with what we all know is this explosion in mechanical support. So before we just had drugs, and if the drugs didn't work, we didn't have that much to offer other than transplant, which was obviously only an option for a small number of people. So now I think this idea of being able to figure out early without a year of trial and error who's very unlikely to respond to medical therapy and would be better supported by early mechanical support.
You want to shift them into
Before they're sicker,
Who we think we can make an impact with
and before their kidneys
medicines.
Go, which once they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah.
So even troponin and uric acid, which you mentioned, are so comfortable to a clinician who may get that, you know, ordinarily. And the combination of troponin and BNP is a bad combination.
Yeah, and I think, also biomarkers can both identify overall risk, but also particular therapeutic intervention. So, for example, in the NIH Heart Failure Network, we're doing a trial looooking at allopurinol in patients with elevated uric acid. So, biomarkers can both help us understand risk, but also potentially identify specific therapeutic targets in individual patients.
And that's a simple one. something like allopurinol. Yeah, well, I'm going to wrap up here because our time is growing short, but I want to thank you both because this is fascinating, and I want to wish you luck in your presentation.
Thank you.
And we keep our fingers crossed for Guided that we're going to get funded. So I want to thank our audience today, and I think this presentation hopefully will help the clinician take a look at their patients and better risk stratify, have some guidance, and please remember that when you think you've done your best on medications, take another look. There may be a little bit more. So I close today. This is Ileana Pina, and thank you for joining us. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Guiding Heart Failure Therapy, an update on the role of biomarkers. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.